Hi, a quick reminder of what this podcast is all about. Win building, achieving success in something. I've interviewed a whole group of amazing people who've all achieved something worthwhile, and they tell an inspiring and interesting story, each one of them. So that's what the podcast has been here for. I'm particularly passionate about helping people to achieve their dreams. I'm a trained coach, both a mental coach, but also helping sports teams. I'm fascinated by how people put together a successful achievement. So that's what the podcast is about. Today I have a very special episode with Mark Lewis, who's a UK YouTuber. He's in fitness. And today we talk about his journey. We talk about where he got his drive from, but also his thoughts on inspiration, and we talk a little bit about men's mental health, which is a topic I'm particularly passionate about at the moment. I hope you enjoy it. Please stick with it. Like, subscribe, comment down below. And go and check out Mark's channel on YouTube as well. It's definitely worth it, and I'm sure you'll enjoy it. Hi, you're listening to Wimbledon, hosted by me, Nick Ray. Hi everyone, welcome back to the podcast. Finally, I get started again with this podcast journey. I've taken a bit of a break and so I'm back on it, and I'm very excited as usual, and I've got a special guest today. So Mark Lewis, I probably introduced him beforehand, but I'm going to throw it over to Mark now to tell us, Mark, why are you here on this podcast? Why do you think I want you here?
the second part of that question, I have no idea. We'll find out. I am, I suppose, what am I might be a easy way to describe that. I'm a fitness YouTuber, which even as I say it out loud now sounds ridiculous. I'm 48. Not that you can't be a anything YouTuber at 48, but it's less common. I have a background that is unusual for a fitness YouTuber in that I don't have a fitness background at all. So go back to when I was 35, I was working in an office, very unfit, and had been hugely overweight and not exercising since my teenage years. Just to be fair, probably like many people sat in an office in their mid-30s, and figured that I should probably get in shape. And so started a journey of doing that, losing weight and then getting into fitness, that got me to a point where I was fitter than I'd ever thought I could be, not elite athlete level by any stretch, not at all, but fitter than most. And I realized that getting fitter than most actually just came down to, for me at least, doing what most people won't do, which doesn't really mean kind of going all out mad and training for hours and hours a day like a professional athlete. It just means going out on a Sunday to jog when it's raining and other people wouldn't bother. Or it means on a Sunday going to the gym when other people probably wouldn't bother. And just by doing those little things, those little bits that most people don't bother doing, you hopefully avoiding injury and bad luck and so on, just progress to a point where you end up better than most people at the thing you're doing. So for me, it was running. And I got to a point where I was running better than most. I wasn't a good runner by any stretch. But if you took 1,000 random people in the high street, I would be faster than 500 of them. That was my plan, was always just to be better than most people. And that was a few years ago where I reached that. I got to a point where I was doing things like park runs, which was my bread and butter, really, just going on a Saturday and doing a park run to see if I was getting faster. And I was coming in the top 20-odd runners out of hundreds, which was something that was the complete opposite to when I started, when I was coming at the back, literally. And then I thought, well, this is quite fun. I would talk to other people and explain what I'd done, and they'd find it quite interesting. So I thought I'd put it on YouTube. That's pretty much it, really. And over the last couple of years, over the duration of COVID, in a way, because it allowed me more time to sit at home and do nothing other than YouTube, it's I was going to say it's blown up. People keep saying to me, oh, your channel is blowing up, and the numbers are very good compared to where they were, but these things are all relative. I am, in the YouTube world, by no means a large YouTuber. There are people out there, as my kids are constantly telling me, with millions of subscribers that I don't have. So
But kids keep you honest, right?
They do. But as I point out to them, I am better than most. Most YouTubers don't have whatever I have. I think I'm on now 60,000 subscribers. So I've moved into a place where I can regard myself as YouTubing for a living. Actually, I'm in the process now of transitioning from my old job, which I still have to do a bit to sort of wind up into being a full-time YouTuber. That's in a very, very simple summary. That's for the last 15 years, which are the interesting bits.
Yeah, well, I'm interested in the whole journey as well, though. So I'm actually interested in backing up even more, because I think what I feel about you, and I've watched a lot of your videos, and I was sort of intrigued, and I've really enjoyed your videos. But you're extremely sort of positive, outgoing. You clearly have this. You're funny as well, as we just discussed it. You did some stand up back in the day, just before we started recording. And so you've got this kind of real nice like manner, and I think that's part of the reason you have that charisma to be able to be a YouTuber as well, right? That's obviously plays a part of it. It's not just the fitness and the fact that you've changed. But where does that all come from? And like, have you always had that sort of urge to be a performer or be charismatic, or like, where do you think that came from?
So I suppose so. Let's go right back then. So I was a gym instructor when I was 14, which would have been, so I was born in 73, so late 80s, early 90s, back when rules and regulations and health and safety didn't exist. And I was a tall 14-year-old, pretended I was older, and somebody gave me a job in a gym. So from a very early age, I was coaching people, training people, not in anything particularly fancy or complicated, but more in circuit training. I'd run circuit training classes, for example. I'd be playing, which basically consisted of playing the Rocky soundtrack and telling people to do press-ups. That was it. But as a 14, 15-year-old telling grown adults to do things, I suppose it gave me, it taught me that actually you can just, if you appear confident, people will do as they're told when they listen to you. So a lot of people are very hesitant when they talk to groups of people or individuals that they're not going to come across the way they want. I learned from an early age that if you just appear that you know what you're doing and say it confidently enough, then people will just listen and do as they're told in a good way. So I did that for a bit. And then when I got to 20-ish, 21 maybe, I was still working in the gym. And then I had my first child and realized that it was borderline impossible back then. I don't know the situation now, but you couldn't raise a child on a gym instructor salary. Not really. You'd have to sell the child, would probably be more profitable. So I went and left. I literally quit. I thought I need to find another job. And so I moved into life insurance sales, which would have been the mid-90s. And back in the mid-90s, you could just literally go into life insurance sales. You just went to a big life insurance company and said, employ me, please. And they would. And you got 6 months to see if you could sell anything. And if you did, they kept you. And if you didn't, they sacked you. Nowadays, quite rightly, that's a completely impossible path to take. You can't do that. I've had to employ people. And you know, we look for people with degrees in economics and stuff that I never had. I left proper school at stuff. 16. Yeah, indeed. So I've employed people that are massively more qualified than me. But back then you could do it. So I started selling life insurance for life insurance companies. And within a few years, found that my ability to talk to people older than me confidently, that I'd learned as a 15-year-old gym instructor, actually translated reasonably well to that role. I was taught, once I learned what life insurance was, and mortgages were and investments and so on, I found that talking to people that were much older than me was as easy to talk to them about life insurance as it was to talk to them about doing some star jumps or something. And that then meant that I was able quite early on to start my own business, and that whole career path became quite straightforward for me. Again, in a way that would probably be harder now with the rules and regulations are much, much different. But back then, in very simple terms, and it wasn't good, but if you had the ability to talk, I was going to say well is not the right word. Basically, if you were a bit of a sort of traditional salesman type, you could do very well. The industry got rid of a lot of those people, quite rightly, and the people that were left, the people that could talk quite well, and also paid attention and did their exams and studied and so on, as I did. So basically, my ability to be a decent life insurance salesman caught up with my ability to be a talkative one. And that was it. I then just spent the next, well, I still do it. It's still my job today, my proper job. The problem I had when I reached my mid-30s was that it was something that I'd done, I thought, temporarily to solve the problem of the problem. That's the wrong way to describe my beautiful daughter.
But I understand where you're coming from, though.
but what the hell? Yeah, the problem of my child. So and she still needs money today. So it hasn't changed. It was a temporary solution to that, and it ended up just being I use the term, and I'm always very careful is not the right word. I say this often, and I often worry that it comes across wrong. I got myself into a sort of a successful rut. So by the time I was in my late 20s, early 30s, I was thinking, I don't like doing this particularly. I don't mind it, but it's not a lot. I don't have a passion for this. I'm quite good at it, and I love talking to people, but the subject matter doesn't enthral me at all. But I can't do anything else because I'm earning reasonably good money. And if I was to stop doing this, I'm trained for nothing else at all. And by then I couldn't even go be a gym instructor because the rules have changed on that. So I literally could do nothing. And so I carried on, and friends would say to me, what on earth are you moaning about? You make a good living. Why are you complaining? Shut up and go to work. So I was just stuck. I wanted to do something that I loved, which I didn't know what that would be or what it was. But I was stuck doing this thing that I was just too good at to just walk away. I had by then 4 children, so I was literally I had there was no way out, and I shouldn't complain about it because I have 4 great children. I had have a great job. It was all on paper. There are, I'm sure, millions of people around the world that would have jumped at the opportunity to have either my lovely family or my very prosperous job. So I shouldn't complain. I'm not complaining. But it wasn't light to my fire. And then at 35, mid-30s, as well as deciding that I wanted to start getting in shape, it was a midlife crisis, probably the best way to describe it. At 35, man, it's a bit early for a midlife crisis, but it was a crisis. I thought, I need to get in shape. That's one thing. And I really would love to find something to do that was that just made me laugh. Actually, that was the, I remember this is literally the moment that I was reminiscing at the age of 33, 34, 35. So this probably 15 years ago, maybe. I was reminiscing with a friend who I'd worked in the gym with. And back when we were 17 or 18, we'd been sent on a course to learn about how to resuscitate people that were dying in our gym from heart attacks, health and safety type thing. And on that course, there was me and this guy, Steve, that was a gym instructor with me, and a new guy, I can't remember his name, but he was a South African guy. And he'd come over to live in the UK and was had found gym instructing as a temporary way of making some money. So we're all sat on this training course, and a guy gets up at the front, and it's all very dull. He's telling us about people having myocardial infarctions, heart attacks, and how to resuscitate them and so on. And at one point he said, we're just bored out of our minds. And at one point he says, heart attack, heart disease is the biggest killer in the Northern Hemisphere. At which point the South African guy says, and my South African is not very good, says, geez, could you live in South Africa then? Which is just, it's not even that funny, but we just started laughing like little children, and we're supposed to be adults and we ended up getting asked to leave because we were just crying with laughter at the stupidity of this whole thing. And I remember at 35 remembering that and thinking, do you know what? I haven't laughed like that since. I'm happy, I'm successful, da 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 da. But Aaron just laughed. What can I do to laugh? And at the same time, this sounds a weird one, Ricky Gervais, who's also from Reading, where I live, went to school not far from where I am now, actually, was doing quite well with The Office and stuff. I just remember thinking, there's a guy that's 40, a bit older than me at the time, and has just found what he can do at 40, and has just nailed it. It's not, you know, to think at 35, it's too late. It's not too late. He. I mean, this sounds stupid, but I just thought, if he can do it, how hard can it be? It sounds nuts. So I literally signed up for a stand-up comedy course and just thought this would be funny to do. It would just make me laugh. And I went to London for 6 weeks, every weekend, Saturdays and Sundays, and did a stand-up comedy course that had been done by a bunch of people that are now successful. Rod Gilbert, the Welsh guy, did it. Greg Davis, Josh Widdicombe, a bunch of people did this course. And I just laughed for 6 weeks. And at the end of it, we got to do a little presentation to friends and family. None of my friends and family came because no one knew I was on it. I was sneaking off every weekend to do this thing. And I did quite well. I was asked to close the show because my stuff during the 6 weeks had been good. And I thought I should give this a go. People said to me afterwards, you're actually quite funny. Why aren't you, you know, what are you going to do now? And I said, I want to go back to being a financial advisor again. And they said, you've got to try this. Just do a bit of it. So I started going to do stand-up open mic gigs and spent 6 or 7 months doing it. And got to a point where I was on TV. I did a sort of the equivalent of a sort of Britain's Got Talent type show that actually I got beaten by Josh Widdicombe on that, who's gone on to be a very successful stand-up. And realised, and we were talking about this earlier, I realised that actually you can just, you know, if you sort of put yourself on stage, not literally, although that was literally, put yourself on stage, do your thing, and just see how it goes. You know, I was never frightened of getting up on stage. I was never frightened of talking to clients. I was never frightened in the gym of talking to people and saying, do your press ups. I was never frightened of it. But what I was always slightly unsure of was whether what they were hearing from me was being received well. Mm. The people in the gym appeared to be tired and the clients at work appeared to just invest the way I suggested. So I assumed it was okay, but there's nothing really obvious. And the thing I learned at stand-up was that you got up on stage, you did your thing, and instead of wondering how has it been received, you knew, because instantly people are laughing or not. And that for me was this kind of click moment where I thought, oh, this is what I would, if I was 21, 22, I wish I'd done this, because this is amazing. Yeah. I can sit in the car on the way to a gig, refine a joke, laugh to myself that it's funny, half hour later do it, and a few hundred people are laughing back at me. And I thought, this is what I want to do forever.
At the time. Yeah, it's the immediate feedback loop. It's so instantaneous, you can't avoid it. And so you know if something's hit well, or and so you can tell whether your goal or your whatever is being achieved. It's an interesting thing that parallels with sport, right? Because sport is great for that. You have a very direct feedback loop, usually, whether it's a team sport and you need to score goals, or whether it's a run and you need to hit yourself your own time or your best, you know, pace or whatever it is.
Yep.
So it has very, and that's actually one of the things I'm very interested in, because I find it interesting how business is so much more complicated to get the immediate feedback loops, especially with like life insurance. Of course, you've probably got monthly goals and yearly targets and whatever, and you've got, you know, you've got a profit and loss account and things, but it's not as instantaneous, and you can manage those numbers to sort of say different stories depending on how good your accountant is and things. So
absolutely,
so yeah, I think stand up is
and also that people are, when you're selling something to somebody, even if it's something that they really do need, there is, you're never quite sure if they've said yes, they've agreed to go, because you could say, well, hang on a minute, you suggested that person does that investment and they've just invested £1 million. Obviously, you know, that's your feedback loop. Mm. But But I would sometimes wonder, is that really the case? Have they done that? It's not, I'll try to explain this very badly. With laughter in stand-up, somebody has no control over that. The joke's exactly. funny, and it's just they laugh. You can't sell someone to laugh. You can't phrase things in such a way that they end up sort of handing over their money and then thinking, oh, what on earth happened? Yeah. Laughter, they're either laughing or they're not. And so with my job, I was very good at selling things, and that kind of clouded my understanding of whether people were genuinely responsive to what I was doing, or I was just a very good salesman. It was kind of murky. Stand up, I just found incredibly raw. I'm saying this, and you're either laughing or you're not laughing. Right. And it was just, I loved it, absolutely loved it. I have gone back to it only in the form of doing things like wedding speeches and stuff. I mean, I just jump at the chance. I stopped doing stand up dead in the water at one point because. Because it wasn't working in terms of a long-term career, but if I whenever I get the chance to stand up and be funny, I just love it. I love doing it. I did my wedding. My wedding was last. When was my wedding? Last year. And my I told people my groom speech was going to run to about 35 minutes. People were saying you're insane. That no one does that. And it was just best 35 minutes of the day. Apart from the getting married bit, that's pretty cool too.
But just in case your wife watches this or listens to this and is still listening.
Yeah. Well, she laughed. I mean, it was most people say, or a lot of people say, oh, I'm nervous, it's the worst bit. And I was just, I woke up that morning thinking, I'm going to get married, that's very cool. And I get to do my wedding speech.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And I wonder if people laugh and so on. Yeah.
That's awesome. So listen, I've planned out what I wanted to ask you about, but you've struck something with me because it's I've seen a theme. You said you left school at 16. You're working at 14 as a gym instructor. I know because I've tried to run a YouTube channel myself. There's a lot of hard graft, and I'm a total nerd actually with YouTube, so I know a lot about YouTube. I'm just not a very good YouTuber myself, but I know that there's so much work involved in planning and persistently, you know, going through and just delivering constantly videos, which you've managed to achieve. And I'd say with your work ethic, what you've described in the way you've worked through your life and the way you then set up your own business, which I know through my own experience as well, is extremely difficult and challenging. I'm seeing a pattern of work ethic, right? I'm seeing a pattern, and I know you're trained. I've seen you train, so I know there's a hell of a work ethic there as well. However you want to frame it as above average or whatever, you're putting in a lot of hard graft to get fit and challenge yourself. So like, do you think that's from something even earlier than like gym instructor? Like, was there something in you which was like, and why did you leave school at 16? Like, what was the pattern for you that was like going to be a graft? I don't know if that's, that sounds bad. Grafter sounds a bad thing, but I mean, a hard worker.
Yeah. No,
I'm thinking of grifter. Yeah. No, not a grifter, a grafter.
Yeah, it's a tricky one to I mean, let's do the YouTube thing first and then jump backwards. What I learned at work, and in fact, actually, this covers everything. You say the work ethic leads to the success at anything, and there is that. But the other thing that I have stumbled upon, it might be the wrong word, but when I look at what other people are doing, so with YouTube, for example, I started YouTube with no fitness background other than me getting in shape. I look in shape for an average 48 year old, but I'm not the classic YouTuber kind of jumping around looking like The Rock or something. I'm not what other people are exactly. In fact, there aren't many older YouTubers doing fitness anyway. So there's that. So I thought, well, how am I going to be different? I've got no qualifications, I've got no training. I can't really talk about my training in detail. And none of my YouTube stuff is, this is how many reps you should do, or how many sets you should do, or this is what you should eat. It is literally, this is what I'm doing, I hope you find it funny. I hope you find it motivating. Get off your butt and go and do something. I don't care whether you then go and play guitar or you copy me. It doesn't really matter. As long as you're motivated, I don't mind. So I thought, well, what I need to do then is I need to make sure that my kit is top notch. And luckily, because of my job, it allowed me the ability to treat YouTube like a business and invest into it. And people said, wow, the amount of money you're spending on camera gear and stuff. But I said, well, hang on a minute. If I was setting up even a little tiny cafe, I'd be spending thousands and thousands of pounds on things to run that little business. And if I want to treat YouTube as a little business, which I did, even though that seemed wildly optimistic at the time, to spend a few thousand pounds on the gear to make it look professional actually to me made perfect sense. And the same when I ran my own business as an advisor, I started it looking very slick and professional because why not? You know, start as you mean to go on. I don't want it. I never the same when I was a gym instructor. I would prepare my Rocky soundtrack cassettes so that everything that I did was as basically. I didn't want people to have an opportunity to sit and think, oh, he's only 14. Should we be listening to this guy? I wanted them to be thinking, oh, wow, he's nailed it. The music's perfect. Everything's laid out ready. So I just make sure there was nothing that I could control that wasn't perfect. Mm. And so with YouTube, I tried to be as professional as possible, not to make up for not being able to do anything else, but just to make sure that that isn't an issue. And then if people don't like it, it's me. They're not tuning in because the video quality is rubbish or the audio is rubbish or whatever. That is taken care of. So that there's that. And that with work ethic. Because work ethic done badly, not done smart, I suppose, is kind of work ethic in the wrong... Yeah, exactly that. I could be as diligent as I like, holding my iPhone, wobbling it about. It's not going to work. Going back in terms of where's the work ethic come? So the making sure it all looks very professional just came from learning that over time with anything I ever did. I thought if I take care of the things I can do, then that's half the job done. Where does the work ethic come from? I've absolutely no idea. I've no idea. It's... Yeah, I don't know. I left school at 16 because I didn't like school. It wasn't because of some sort of drive to go and work. I mean, I wanted to work because I figured that was more enjoyable. And basically, I could go to the gym. I said to my boss at the gym, I'm going to quit school tomorrow. Can I come and just do full-time gym instructing? And he said, yeah, a bit of lifeguarding and stuff. And yeah, start tomorrow. So after doing 2 weeks of A-levels, I went in and quit. And went to the gym and just picked up more hours there, and that was paid.
Yeah,
£11 an hour. So it was just them were the days. So it was just a better thing. It wasn't a work ethic thing as such. I just didn't like school, and I did like working in the gym. So yeah, I don't know. I honestly, I just don't know. One thing I do, I always remember my dad worked incredibly hard. Still around today, 117 or something is. He worked.
Hi, Dad. You're watching this. Your son's still funny.
He doesn't even know what a podcast is, so I'm perfectly safe. So he worked incredibly hard, but never earned a huge amount of money. Always earned enough. I mean, I also lived in a generation where your house became your pension and everything. So they, my mum and dad are fine. But he worked incredibly hard. And I suppose watching that, I remember thinking, watching him, I remember thinking, you know, I wonder how to not be better than that. That's the wrong way of describing it. But just to have, I always remember thinking, do you know what? He should be rewarded more for the amount of work he does. There was that. I always thought he's doing way more work than people making more money. And that didn't seem fair to me. So I was always very aware, which is why I went to financial services, of trying to find things where hard work did equal decent reward. Because there are many people who work incredibly hard, but they've just kind of picked the wrong thing to work hard in. and therefore the reward is low. And life is clearly not just about financial reward, but equally, if you're going to throw yourself into something, throw it into something with a financial reward just seems to make sense. So I've always been, I mean, that kind of probably comes back to working smart again. If I'm going to put the effort in, do I put it into being this or that? YouTube is a good example. If you only have to look around at the kids making an absolute fortune and realize that it is a world where if you do okay, you do okay. So why not put my effort into that? Equally, stand-up comedy is another example. You can put all the hours in the sun in, and unless you're just lucky, it doesn't happen
It's a really interesting point. And I think the working smart, I've told you the chapters of my book, but like understanding the game you're in or whatever it is you're in to try to achieve a win, and whatever that win is, whether it's financial gain, whether it's winning a championship, whether it's getting your best park run time, whatever that is, understanding what it is and then understanding what parameters can I control within this to achieve that win. Like, what's the best strategy for achieving that win? And those parameters come in around, well, what can I actually affect here? Because there is an element of luck to everything in life, right? Wherever you're born, genetics are, and all of that.
Yeah.
In the end, there's a lot of things you can control yourself too. And I think that's what you've just said speaks perfectly to that.
Yeah. I think football's a good example. I've never watched a game of football in my life. Ever. I watched the 1990 World Cup. I think that was Lineker and Gascoigne crying and all that sort of stuff, wasn't it? I probably watched 15 seconds of that because my dad made me. So I'm not a football fan at all. I know nothing about it. So I've spent many, many, many years, as we were, hearing from people moaning about footballers earn. And as somebody who's not a football fan, you'd think that I might be somebody that would agree with that and say, yeah, it's outrageous to get millions of pounds. And it always just occurred to me, what are these people moaning about? The only reason you can moan is if you tried to be a footballer, you put in all the time and effort, and it didn't work out for you. Then you could maybe have a legit moan about your bad luck. But to be someone that picked to be a cafe owner and moan about what somebody who picked to be a footballer earns makes no sense to me, because you could have tried to do that. And the win in that world is that it's a known thing. I mean, no one's going into the world today not knowing that the wins over there are astronomical. If you fancy them, go and have a go at them. Or don't, but then don't moan that the guys that did. I remember Tracy Emin did that bed sculpture thing, which was just her bed, and it sold for millions of pounds. And people said, well, that's rubbish. Anyone could do that. And she said, yeah, but they didn't. I did. And that was stuck with me. I thought, exactly that. I had a conversation with a guy today moaning about how much Instagram models make for just being an Instagram model. And I say, I hear you, but equally, you could get yourself in incredibly good shape and wander around half naked, take photographs of yourself and have what they have. Well, I don't want to do that. Well, that's cool. Yeah. Then don't. But then don't mind that they do, because you could try and do it too. So I've always been very aware of where the opportunities lie, and then focus on those. I guess working smart, I guess. But I've always tried to. And I say to my kids as they're going into work now, they're 23, 21, 18, 15, and I say to them, if you love your job, that's great. Absolutely, that's great. But just think 5-10 years time, where does that job go? And if it's not, excuse me, if it doesn't go in the direction you want, just be aware of that. Just think a bit more, not intelligently is the wrong word, just a bit more down the line. You know, when I started YouTube, it always was a goal for me to have, I thought, well, if I get 100,000 subscribers, if I get 1 million subscribers, what does that mean? It doesn't mean I get it. But if I'm starting on a road, where does the road go? And there are some jobs where you think, well, no matter what this road only ever goes. For example, I'm trying to think of a job that doesn't belittle anyone doing that job, which I don't intend to do. But everyone can think of careers, jobs where you know that no matter how good you do it, no matter how many hours you put into
checkout person in Asda. let's say.
Yeah, indeed, indeed. Although the back of my mind is where you work your way up to being a manager of the store.
Of course.
But I
think a lot of people doing it are doing it to get themselves to somewhere else, probably. I mean, I think that's probably
fair. Absolutely. And if that's the plan, that's cool. But don't do it thinking this, I'm going to do this for 10, 15, 20 years, unless you don't mind the rewards that come from that. And some people might be perfectly happy with that. That's amazing if you are. But it always annoys me when people say, oh, yeah, they have this, they have that. And I think, well, what did you try and have that? You know, Oh, the Spice Girls earn millions of pounds. Well, how did your singing lessons go? Never took
it. Well, if you never took it, the Spice Girls.
Exactly. When they were 14 doing dance lessons, were you? No. Well, then why are you moaning about what they're doing?
It is interesting, and I think it's also interesting to think about, you know, the talents and things. I was kind of intrigued about your kids, actually, because you've mentioned them quite a lot, and there's one or two cameos in videos, but you've kind of generally kept them off, and you mentioned the story a few times. I don't know which son it is, but poor guy, you keep telling this story about the challenge of why you started YouTube and the thousand views. Your son, I'll tell it for the audience.
Yeah.
The son basically got 1,000 views on his YouTube channel, was quite chuffed with himself, came to his dad and said, oh, dad, look, I've got 1,000 views. And you're like, that's nothing. That's easy. And he said, no, it's not. And then you said, all right, I'll set up a YouTube channel and prove you wrong. And am I getting it more or less right? Because I feel pretty bad for your son right now. I'm hoping his YouTube channel
is better. That's pretty much it. Well, the only part of that that's wrong is that when he came to me and said 1,000 views, I didn't say that's, I had no idea what that meant. I knew nothing about YouTube. I had never watched YouTube for anything other than tutorials on how to fix my boiler or something. So I said to him, that must be easy.
Okay, there you go.
If you've got 1,000 views, it must, anyone can do it, clearly, because you just did. And your stuff's rubbish. And he said, no, it's not. Yeah, you couldn't do 1,000 views. So I said, ha ha, I will show you. So yeah, September 11th, 2018, I set up a YouTube channel. Actually, he set it up for me. I had to set it up. And then he said, well, you're going to be rubbish because what are you going to film it on? So, and what are you going to edit it on? So I literally went to the Apple store and bought an iMac and Final Cut Pro and then went and bought a DSLR camera and basically spent thousands of pounds to make my kid, Harvey, look silly. Yeah.
And this ongoing project is now 60,000 subscribers deep. You just went over 1 million views on your Eliud Kipchoge video. Amazing.
I did,
Harvey. Congratulations on that. That was incredible.
That was quite cool. Now, and to be fair, he's actually, Harvey is the one, I have four kids. Harvey is the one, and the reason they only have minor cameos is because they are all young people, and I know the implications of putting myself on YouTube, which is there forever. They, even if they think they do want to put themselves on YouTube forever, they might not think that in 20 or 30 years' time. So I sort of regulate how much they appear, just in case they decide at 25, 30, 35.
Pull me out of all your videos, Dad. You're too famous.
Exactly. I'm not going to go back and blur their faces on thousands of videos. So they're in it occasionally, but that's all. So Harvey, because he's now 15, because he was 11 when it started, he actually found it really quite cool.
Okay.
Apart from beating him, he would, for example, still does. He watches every single one of my videos before it goes up, to check it for problems and errors, and also to make sure it's funny. Because I figure if my 11-year-old, now 15-year-old, is laughing at me, and I'm laughing at me, then I've covered a big enough range. The older kids, my daughter, who's in her 20s, has her own daughter now, just regards the whole thing as just, you know, dad just being nuts, has no interest in it really, and why should she? And my two middle sons, George and Joshua, who are 21 and 18, I think they just find it all slightly embarrassing, mainly because especially Joshua, he's very into his fitness himself. So all his friends, all his peer group are into fitness. And they'll often say to him, hey, I saw your dad's latest video. It was amazing. Your dad's in awesome shape. And it's a hard balance for an 18-year-old when you're told, oh, your dad's, your dad's amazing, and he's what do you think as a kid? Do you think that's the most embarrassing thing I've ever heard? Do you think it's quite cool, yeah, that's my dad? So there's a weird sort of mental conflict.
I'm just going to go out there on a limb and say one day, at least, if he doesn't already, he's going to be pretty proud of you. Like, I feel like you're already, and I feel like I'm wrapping up now. I've got plenty more to ask you, but definitely you're already a great role model for lots and lots of people out there, especially men, I'd say, but also your sons. I mean, that's one of the main things I have in back of my mind for all of it, including this. It's not, I've said it before on the podcast, it's like leaving something behind for my kids to sort of hear interesting conversations dad had when he was in his 40s with interesting people around the world. Like, how cool was that? Like, hopefully, you know, and maybe they'll never listen to it, but they do.
And to be fair, you know, that when the Kipchoge video going through a million was something that they had to say. Yeah, you know, they actually came to me. Normally what happens is I will go to them and say, look, 50,000 views, you know, shove it in their face, not in a nasty way, just you know. But with Kipchoge, that when it got close to a million, they were coming to me and saying, "Hey, your videos are 900,000 views."
You're so like, I know. I'm refreshing every 5 seconds.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Literally that. Yeah. It's they are. In fact, funny enough, I've got this is quite cool over here. This is when you do YouTube and you get 100,000 views, YouTube sends you a little plaque, not 100,000 subscribers. YouTube sends you a little plaque that you stick on your wall. I'm nowhere near 100,000 yet, but at 10,000 subscribers, my kids made me this 10,000 subscriber thing for Christmas 2 years ago. So that's quite cool. So that's my 10,000 subscriber plaque that they made for me.
Oh, so they are proud. I have told. That's cool.
They have. Although I told them the other day that when I get the 100,000 one, it'd be good because I can chuck this in the bin.
Of course you did. It doesn't surprise me at all. So
until then, it's proud.
I wanted to go to a slightly more serious topic, because I feel like there's something within your story, which you mentioned about midlife crisis. And I listened to a really interesting podcast yesterday, which I can link below if people are interested, and I'll also send to you. It's a guy called, it's a podcast called Modern Wisdom. And I've got really into it recently because he's had a lot of conversations about kind of masculinity and sort of modern day issues with masculinity and you know, it kind of faces up to a lot of the woke stuff, but in a positive way of talking about men and helping men and things. And I just kind of been fascinated by it because I went through a pretty rough moment in my life in my mid-30s as well. In fact, and fitness kind of turned that around for me as well. And I recognize a lot of things that I hear about in the press and stuff about mental health and things. And I feel like I'm fascinated by it because I feel like people recognize, especially young men, it's the leading cause of death is suicide in young men in under 40 in the UK, I think, and in many places around the world. And so what I find interesting is people are worrying about like the moment the guy's in a crisis moment, but then we're not having many conversations about all the things leading up to it. And so I listened to this one guy yesterday, and he was talking about all of that. They talked about all these different things that men in their middle life kind of go through, this U-curve where, you know, you're supposed to have made it at that point. You might be successful. You might have got into a certain position in your career. Maybe your kids have become sort of self-sustainable or to some extent, and, you know, they're no longer needing you in the same way as young kids do and things. And so they were talking about this, and I was like, this is kind of fascinating because it's like, I know a lot of people who've been in similar situations, and I've myself found myself comparing to others and having those insecurities and having a very secure and quite well-paid job that I had previous to coronavirus coming along. and then you know, like, just the fear of losing that, the fear of not being able to provide for my family in a kind of conventional sense. So I'm just rambling at this point, but I'm kind of wanted to throw it a little bit towards you in terms of like, have you got thoughts around that topic? Because, and the reason I ask you is not because I'm wanting you to some, make some giant confession or anything. I don't expect that whatsoever. But the guy on the podcast had a really nice expression called the midlife doldrums. Because what he said was like, midlife crisis means you, if you have a crisis, you have to do something about it and you have to take action, which is kind of what you said. You like, I'm going to get fit. I'm going to take these actions and move forward. But a lot of men are going through these like doldrums, which is like, okay, things are going well. I haven't really got anything proper to complain about. And my life is, you know, on paper, great. Why do I feel this shit? You know, why am I feeling like this?
Yeah, yeah.
So I was just kind of wanting to throw that at you. If you've got any thoughts around that, any kind of experiences, because your YouTube channel, and presumably this is one of the good reasons for doing it, is having a positive influence on men, maybe even in that situation, maybe in those situations. So I was just wondering kind of like your thoughts on that and like go.
Yeah, no, I mean, actually on your last point first, one of the things that I never expected but is every day a motivator to just make more content is the number of people that contact me from all over the world and say, yeah, things either were bad or they are bad right now, but watching your stuff, not necessarily only your stuff, but your stuff is part of how I have either got to where I want to be or getting to where I want to be, or tomorrow I'm going to start getting to where I want to be because I watched one of your videos. And I reply, and I almost dread the day when I'm too big. I mean, nice problems to worry about, too big on YouTube to not reply to those sort of things. I'd reply to every one of those people on Instagram or wherever they contact me. But those are the fuel for me making another video. There'll be times where I think, oh, I don't want to do two videos this week. And somebody will say, tomorrow I'm going to get my dog, we're going to go for a run, and I'm 50 pounds overweight, but I watched your video on whatever, binge eating or something, and I still ate too much, but I know that isn't a reason to throw the rest of the week away because of what you said. So tomorrow I'm out for a run. That to me is brilliant. I mean, that's the fuel for what I do. Mm-hmm. So there's that. So I'm well aware that there are an awful lot of people and men and the majority of my viewers are men. I wish they weren't. The numbers are getting better, but. It's still heavily male, which is a pity. I'd rather it was a bit more diverse, but it is what it is. A lot of men, yeah, they're struggling. In terms of the doldrums thing is that makes a lot of sense. I can remember being in my 30s and just thinking, yeah, this is just, I'm not having fun. I kind of wonder if I'm now looking at friends of mine that are same age as me, often with slightly younger children, because I have my children quite young. So lots of guys in their 40s have got kids that are a bit younger at school. I mean, my kids are all independent pretty much, even the 15-year-old looks after himself. And I wonder if, and I have zero qualifications in anything, especially this. I wonder if part of it is when you're a dad, I do wonder if it's a dad thing, some of it. I do wonder if guys, you know, that their focus is their partner, then their job, then their kids. And those things are, you know, providing for the family, providing for their children, their spouse, whoever. And I just wonder if people take enough time to just provide for themselves. That was the thing for me, that the switch. I went through a divorce. So I got divorced when I was 10 years ago. And coming out, and no divorces or very few divorces are good. So I don't need to dwell on the intricacies of the divorce, but it's a pretty standard divorce in that it's horrible. When I came out of it, or was coming out of it, I can remember thinking that I need to be incredibly selfish in a really good way, because if I'm not selfish, if I people were saying to me, oh, you know, most important thing is look after your kids. You've got to focus on your kids, 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 kids. And I thought that yes, I hear you. But equally, if I put all my time and effort and attention and emotion and energy into my children, in my current state of newly divorced, still pretty out of shape, person in their doldrums, I'm going to end up failing them anyway, because I'll just be a useless mess. What value is that to them, really? What I need to do is to be incredibly selfish and make sure that I am good, and then see what I can do for them. And the analogy that I use in my head, I've never actually done this analogy on YouTube, but it will pop up one day, no doubt. When I was a lifeguard, in between sessions of gym instructing, we were taught the first thing you do when you're rescuing someone is make sure that you're okay. So if someone's in danger, jumping in the water as your gut reaction is a stupid thing to do, when actually you can leave them drowning a bit longer, go and get a rope and throw them a rope, because then when you do rescue them, it's more likely to be a good process. So that was what I thought. I thought if I throw myself into rescuing my children by literally jumping into the water post-divorce, we're just going to be two drowning people, or there's four kids, maybe five drowning people. So I won't do that. What I'll do is I'll leave them drowning. And they were drowning, because young kids going through a divorce are metaphorically very drowning. Vulnerable. I mean, they were, indeed, massively so. And I left them slightly drowning while I went off and found a rope, but then came back to them soon after and was able to rescue them. Might be the wrong term, but I was there for them in a way that meant I was better. And it worked. And we as a family look back, and I even spoke about this in my wedding speech. We went through a bumpy time, but came out of it massively, massively better. So, and I feel, because I'm selfish, massively better able to look after my family. Here's how I think of it. My wife, my kids, my dogs, my mortgage, whatever it is, it gets 50% of me. That's all I can give it, 50%. But that 50% is quality 50%. They're getting someone fit, healthy, that's going to be here for years, hopefully, can provide financially. That 50% is amazing, or as good as I can get it. The other 50% is for me. And I have friends that give 90%. But because they've only kept 10% for themselves, the 90% they're giving is almost not even worth bothering to give. And yet people will think, oh, yeah, you do so much for your kids. And yeah, you do. But you do, 90%. But it's just, it's all a bit lame. And when you drop dead from a heart attack because you're grossly out of shape at 55, how much percentage are you going to give them then? Not very much. So for me, learning to be selfish and understanding that made me better for anyone around me was a big, and that's the one good thing to come out of that whole marriage breakup was learning I need to be Mark first, not Dad first, not husband first, and my wife isn't wife first. You know, Jenna is Jenna. She has her own life, her own wants and goals, and they come rightly at least alongside me, if not ahead of me, because if she isn't happy, if she isn't doing what she wants to do, then what value is that to me as a partner? So yeah, and the kids are the same. The kids are all told, look after yourself, number one, and then see what you have left for others, and you'll probably find that what you do have for them is quality. So that solved my that helped me understand where I am
it's fantastic advice. You have done a video on it, actually. I'm forgetting your acronym. It's something like SEC, and I was like, he has to put an S on the end of that to be his sex or something like that. You've done a video on it.
I did, you're right,
selfishness, and I was interested when you said that, because I think I'm probably one of those people who struggled to find that balance, and I understand the value of it very much. I also divorced 10, 12, whatever it was, years ago. I'm going to get in trouble with my now wife for not knowing how long ago I divorced, but she never listened to these anyway. So. I had a similar sort of pathway in that way, and I understood, I learned about the selfishness and the fact that I think everyone, like the human nature, we need to be selfish actually to get ahead in life, to be able to succeed. There's some level of selfishness that you need to have, everyone. And I think I love being a dad. Like, it's my number one thing. I've got a 6-year-old and 3-year-old. So I came in way late compared to you. Like, I'm a late starter. And so they're probably, I even took my ear out because I'm like, oh crap, am I hearing them crying in the night now? So I was like, go to bed. I'm interviewing someone, go to bed. But I throw.
So yeah. mine are out getting drunk. Off. So.
But I
you guys look forward to.
I think, you know, I learned not that long ago just how much more selfish I need to be, and especially with fitness, because for me, my fitness journey has been one of, like, I realized back then I need to have a level of fitness, I need to have a sustained sort of activity level to keep my head in shape, like to keep myself mentally healthy. If nothing, I call it an engine. I call my heart my engine. I'm like, it's good engine work, you know, and I keep working at that. Yep. And I love challenging myself in a similar way to you, not quite as extreme, but with these young kids, it's also, it throws everything up in the air, because it becomes a lot of unpredictable things, as you'll no doubt remember. Like, you don't have a lot of opportunity absolutely. To sort of really structure a training week when, you know, they're getting up between 6 and 7. And you mentioned that in one video as well. You even said, like, if you've got young kids, I can't help you. If you've got this, and I'm like, you can help, funnily enough, but you don't realize you can help. But I understand where you're coming from, because people with young kids is just, it's like a hurricane. You just got to kind of get through, and then hopefully things settle down a bit when you stop having to change.
Yeah, I was lucky because exactly. I mean, and I remember how hard that is. I was quite lucky because when I had that sort of click moment in my head, in fact, I can remember the moment I had to go to London to see a client. And I got off the tube in London and I was stood on the platform, and there were a group of mums, and they were out for the day. They all had their pushchairs with their kids in. There were maybe 6 of them, and I was waiting for the next train or something. So I'm just watching them. And I thought, do you know what? Every single one of them looks exactly the same. They are mums. They have effectively handed in their whoever they were card and exchanged it for, I'm just a mum. Their conversation was about being mums. They put the effort they put into their kids and the pram, you know, they're the 500 quid mumma and papa prams and stuff. But then that's not how they were dressing. The money's all gone on them. I just remember thinking, that's amazing, and they're probably, and if you ask them, they're probably delighted with how they're going about their life, and that's good. But I do wonder, when your kid is no longer in the pushchair, when your kid's girls, having had a girl, 15, and so I'm off out tonight, do you want some advice and some help and some guidance? And no, I don't want anything from you. What are you talking about? I you have nothing to offer me, Dad, at all. I'm a 15-year-old girl. Good night. I'm going. And then you're left thinking, I'm a dad. What else can I do? So I was quite lucky in that the moment that I thought I need to stop being a dad, but that isn't the top of my CV, dad. I was quite lucky because my kids were almost old enough for me to say to them, you're all going to struggle for 6 months while I go and discover what it is I want to do. If they would have been 3 years old, 4 years old, 5 year olds, I couldn't have done that. Or if I had done that, it would have gone very badly. That they were teenagers, it wasn't great, but long term it would have worked out. So it's a tricky one. When you have young children, I just think there are some things you can do. And my gym is near a playing field, and every time I go there, the parents are stood along the line watching their kids play football or whatever. And I've done that. I took my kids to basketball. They were quite good at basketball. So I spent thousands of hours watching them play basketball. And looking back, if I'd took them to basketball and then while they were playing basketball, went for a run and then came back and picked them up and maybe watched them once a week rather than watching them five times a week, would it have made any difference to their basketball? No, not at all. Would they? If you said to my 21-year-old George now, you know, is your life any different, better, worse because your dad watched every one of your basketball games? No, it makes no difference. Would it have made a difference to me? Yeah. Absolutely. I would have been fitter, healthier. I'd have been more excited about going. And so it's just that. It's just about thinking, okay, I need to be a dad or a husband or I need to do my job, whatever. But I have to find time for me. Otherwise, I'm no use as a dad and a husband and an employee or whatever it might be. Stick your kids in a pushchair, take them to park run, shove them around. Maybe you don't go and watch your kid trampoline or ballet or whatever other things kids do that they never take up. It's all the pointless waste of money anyway. If you don't watch all of those things, does it really matter? And sometimes it does, and some people think, yes, that is my life. Okay, that's cool. But one day it won't be your life. You know, my kids now, I see them occasionally. The older ones literally come and go, normally intoxicated and just falling over. I'm around for them when they need me, but if I was the sort of person that was just, hey, what are we doing this weekend, kids? My boys would be like, what are we doing? Nothing with you. What? We're going to the pub, or we're going here. We're doing this.
Yeah,
we don't want to hang out with a 50-year-old. No, goodbye. So, yeah, indeed, yeah. Go make a video, you embarrassment. So, I'd be left thinking, well, what am I going to do then? And what I would do is what other 50-year-old men do, which is I'd sit in front of the TV and just watch TV because there's what else can you? That's all you've got left. Well, I haven't. I come in here and I do what I love doing. So yeah, there is. I'm very passionate about people abandoning their children to look after themselves, to then come back to their children and say, "Hey, I'm now going to be more used to you than I would have been otherwise." I appreciate it's a gamble, and not everyone.
I think everyone can. I don't think it's a throwaway comment. No, I don't agree. I think it is great advice. It is difficult in some cases to do it. And also it depends on very much on the relationship if you're co-parenting. It depends on your relationship with your parents and how you expect one another to parent.
Of course,
I think it's absolutely possible. And I mean, I'm the embarrassing dad that takes a skipping rope to the playground and I'm standing on the side of the playground skipping. I don't do it all the time.
See,
the kids, even the six-year-old walked up to me and they was like, Dad, it's a bit embarrassing. I'm like, already. I'm embarrassing her.
That's what you should be doing. In fact, you mentioned you did Spartan. Oh, you should be doing chin-ups on the swings and stuff. I do try.
I'm not, Spartan. I need to get better at the monkey bars and stuff, as you pointed out in your videos.
Yeah, well, there you go. Kids' parks are made for dads to practice their Spartan obstacle courses on. No, you can do it. The co-parenting thing is an interesting one because, again, I was very lucky. And we've said already, so much in life comes down to just pure luck. Jenna is my new wife, current wife, whatever.
I got my corrected wife. On that. Reason.
Thank you. Yeah, just my wife. So she's the stepmom to my kids, my boys, and step. Parents are quite handy in what I've been describing because when I say to her, I think we should abandon the children this weekend to go and do a race or something that will be really cool for us, and then Monday we'll be back, but they'll have happy, fun parents in the house. That's good for them because she's a stepmom. She's because your kids are pain in the neck anyway. So. Again, very, very lucky. If she were I can see how people with a classic motherly role adopting spouse would bump into problems with some of that. My situation is very, very lucky in that everybody around me just agrees with what I want to achieve, which is I look after me and they look after themselves. And then we all come together and we're all independent, but therefore great team rather than just team members that you know, who knows who's doing okay within that group, because no one's really.
But presumably, even if they don't watch your YouTube videos, like even if your daughter doesn't watch your YouTube video, she's seen a transition of this dad into a very positive, healthy man who is now really taking control of his life. And I think that, if nothing else, that is a great role model status and a positive thing within the family dynamic, right? So they're going to be happy that they've got that versus what they see around them in other circumstances.
Yeah, hopefully, if they take nothing other than at any point in your life, no matter how old you are or what shape you're in or what, just whenever you like, you can think, I'm going to try this. Yeah. That's really all I, you know, if they could take one thing from it, it's that. And not worry about what anyone else thinks. You know, when I did stand up, people said to me, oh, who did you tell? I didn't tell anybody because what's it got to do with anybody else? I don't care. I did it for me. And when I did YouTube, I didn't tell anybody that I had no friends or family subscribe because no one knew. And yeah, I just said, no, I'm just going to try it and see. And if it's rubbish, and it just doesn't work, so what? When I'm 80, I get this about tattoos a lot. I got my first tattoos on my 45th birthday. I waited until I was 45. So I was old. I was old enough. I thought I'll be old enough that I'm not going to make a mistake. And the important thing, someone said to me the other day, yeah, but what about when you're 85?
So I've said this for years, man. Why do everyone care about what you think about your body when you're 85? You're going to be a wrinkly old man. The least of your worries will be that.
Absolutely. If exactly. Like at 85, I'm going to get out of bed, look in the mirror and think, everything's great, but the tattoos have degraded slightly over the years. It's just complete nonsense. It makes no sense to me. Just you don't regret the things you did, but what I might do at 85 is think, do you know what? I've got a gap here. I really should have had that filled in before the skin's gone. Yeah. So yeah, the tattoos thing is like that for me. I never really wanted tattoos. I'm not a huge tattoo fan. I just thought, why not? I'd try a tattoo. And people go, yeah, but what if you don't like it? Well, what if I don't like it? What if? And I get these conversations from people with, you know, mates with big beer bellies. Do you like your big beer belly? You know, maybe you do, maybe you don't. I've got a tattoo and, it's just, I get very confused sometimes to people's reasons to not do something when actually the consequences of it going wrong are actually completely inconsequential. In fact, the latest tattoo I got, I had no idea what it was going to look like, and I didn't care because I gave the guy an idea of what I wanted and he cracked on. And I thought, if I leave and it's not quite what I wanted, so what? As it turned out, it was amazing. That's cool.
And I'm exactly on the same wavelength as you. I say the only thing is if you're in a job or a work environment where they will negatively judge you. And I think that is kind of old school thinking, but it's still sometimes relevant because I had my mind pop out once. Like I got the end of my dragon, which comes all the way over here. I've got fire of my heart and stuff, but the end of my dragon just came out in a meeting and so it was quite fresh. And the big boss was like, I was like, oh, okay, maybe it wasn't the best move.
I'm quite lucky. Again, lucky. My tattoos are all, I made sure that they were under they put a shirt on. You can't tell. The visible tattoos are interesting because you're right. People are becoming a lot more tolerant. Or maybe just because they're overexposed to it. So it just becomes almost a norm. But it does, when people have tattoos on their hands and stuff, I don't mind that. I don't see that and go, of course I don't. It's a tattoo, wherever you like. But it does make me question the motivation. I do think, you're 18 years old, you've got a tattoo on your hand.
And face as well.
Those are the sort of things that I have.
The face ones, I'm like, extreme. That's a big statement.
Exactly.
And
if you're Mike Tyson, you think, okay, do what you like. But if you then want to go and work for Microsoft or something, yeah, decision making. So tattoos is an interesting one, but yeah, the people that say, oh, but what if? What if? What if? Well, that applies to so much in life. Yeah, what if your YouTube
fails? We've
gone
over an hour, and I love this conversation. I just wanted to ask a couple more things, if I can, to keep you talking. I'm interested in communities, and the reason I mention that is whether you have pondered on this or not. You're a member of a lot of different communities. You're Parkrun, Zwift, Spartan, High Rocks, dogs running events, which we haven't even mentioned, Nixon, trail running events, YouTube community, fitness, presumably motorbiking, because I watched your South Africa video and you don't really talk much about your bikes now, but your first YouTube videos were all about motorbikes, which I know nothing about, by the way.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I'm still involved in those communities as well.
And life insurance, as I now know it is, business ownership. So, like, do you find yourself, like, is that by design, or is it just kind of like you've fallen into these things, you get quite into sort of specific community styled events or something? I just was kind of wanting to throw it at you a little bit, because I was thinking about it. I was like, part of the reason you're successful, I believe, on YouTube as well, is you're hitting quite a few different channels. You've got the dog thing, you know, which is great, and Nixon's super cute, and it's awesome to see that running as well. I'm really interested by it because I love dogs. I don't have a dog for other reasons, but you know, I love dogs and I love seeing that running. And then you've got the kind of the Zwift thing, which I know is huge. And you bastard, you've made me go, I'm now in the process of buying a very cheap at home trainer so I can get on Zwift, which I'm ready. Well, I probably
Zwift is amazing. You won't regret it.
It's uncomfortable, but I'm gonna do it.
Me too.
I'm not gonna buy one. Your fancy Wahoo kicker thing. I can't afford that, so I'm just buying a really crap one. hopefully it'll work. No, but then and the park run thing. You know, you obviously that's kind of it. You said that's your bread and butter of what started you out on this fitness journey. So I'm just kind of interested about your thoughts on that and community and stuff.
Well, there's two things there. Firstly, in terms of the diversity of the topics on YouTube, that's the reason I do that is because I started with the motorbikes because my very first video almost, in fact, it was motorcycling because that was all I did. That was all I had. And I was going to South Africa with Jenna to ride motorbikes around the Karoo Desert. And I thought this would be good for YouTube. And this would be my kid. So that's how it started. And then when I got into the fitness thing, I was fitting in my Spartan runs. The YouTube for 2 years, almost 3 years, from 2018 until the winter of 20, so months into coronavirus, YouTube was very, very quiet relative to what it is now. It was a few hundred views a day, was an astronomical day. And then on Zwift, I started using Zwift online cycling as a means of just training indoors when I couldn't go to the gym because COVID shut the gyms. I fell off my bike, and I'd exercised until I was so tired, I fell off the bike, and suddenly the views went up massively. And it was again relative to now, it's not so good, but at the time I was over the moon. I remember Christmas Day 2020, just I got in so much trouble because I spent all day refreshing my numbers on YouTube. I couldn't believe subscribers were just going up and up and up. Again, relatively speaking. And I thought, oh, this is cool. So I started doing lots of Zwift videos. And the trouble then was that I looked at the top Zwift YouTubers or guys that do cycling as YouTube, and there's a bit of a cap. I mean, cycling is massively popular, but if all you do is cycling, there's a kind of a ceiling as to how many subscribers you're going to get. And I thought, oh, I don't want to fall into that trap. So this goes back to Start As You Mean To Go On. When I started doing stand-up comedy on the very, very first, maybe the second week of doing stuff, I didn't swear in my stand-up comedy that I was writing. And some other people on the course with me said, why? You never swear. It'd be funny if you said this. I don't, because if I ever want to get on TV, it doesn't stop you getting on TV, but it leaves more doors open if you're not swearing. And they said, are you having a laugh? You're on a training course for beginners that you're going to go and do open mics or nothing. TV, and you're nuts. So within 9 months, I was on TV doing my non-sweary material. So I figured with YouTube, the same. Again, if it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen. But why start off in a way that makes it less likely to happen? So what I don't want to do is get stuck just doing Zwift videos and only having that. So what I'll try and do is I'll like a drug dealer, I'll kind of hook them with a Zwift, but then I'll show them a little bit of Nixon going for a run, or I'll show them me in the gym or something, and I'll make it funny so that the people that think I'm funny will still watch that. And now I've built up a community of people that are watching anything I do because they're buying into the idea that it's all a bit of a laugh anyway. So if I'm not on a bike today, so what? And when people email me or DM me and say, oh, I joined your channel because I cycle. I hate running, but man, your running video was good the other day. Yeah. That to me is, I like, oh, I nailed it. That's brilliant. So that's why I diversified the subject matter just to basically hit more people. Yeah. And the Kipchoge video shows why that works. Running video, numbers going up. The reason I surround myself with communities is, and I'm not a community person, really. In fact, one of the things I like about YouTube is that I do it here. I'm on my own. There's no one else here. It's just me and the camera. But it then goes out and I get that instant feedback loop because I get people feedback to me, even though I don't have to actually interact with them other than typing. So it's a weird one. It's a community, but it's not in a way. The reason I go to park run or I put myself in situations where I'm surrounded by other people is that I mentioned this on my recent David Goggins video.
Amazing. Well, congratulations on that as well.
Yeah,
that's
awesome. Thank you. Yeah. Funny enough, my ankles are still swollen from just running.
It was nice to see Jefferson running as well. I mean, I'm a big fan here, so I know all about it.
the dog, Jefferson's still asleep now from that run. Lazy, useless dog. So I mentioned when I was out running at 4 o'clock in the morning that I love being on my own. Running with Nixon over a mountain. Me and Nixon at the end of this month are in Wales doing a mountain race, and there'll be a section I know we'll be on our own in the mountain, in the woods, just us. And I love it. I love thinking, just me doing this. No one else is doing this. That the reason I'm getting any degree of success in fitness and health, in this competition, in this race today, in life, whatever, is because most people just aren't doing what I'm doing. Yeah. So I absolutely love, I use the analogy of an empty classroom where my kids moan, no one else stayed behind to do the extra study at school. I'm in an empty classroom, miserable. All my mates went and played their PlayStation. Good. You want to be in an empty classroom because everyone else in that classroom is your competition in life. And they aren't even there. What are you moaning about? So empty classrooms, you want no one around you doing what you're doing because then you'll be better than them, all things considered. Yeah. So I love training alone. I love running in the rain. I love running in the middle of the night, just me and the dog, and thinking, no one else does this. Of course they do, but no, it feels like that. It feels like you're on your own. And then the success you get feels obvious. That's obviously why I'm getting it. The trouble with that philosophy, that very isolated philosophy, is that sometimes you end up feeling, I literally am on my own. No one else. Why would anybody else even care about what I'm doing? Who cares that I'm running at 4 a.m.? No one, because if they did, wouldn't they be running at 2? So what I like to do is I like to balance my running around in the middle of the night with going to park run, with going to High Rocks, to go, any of those things, going to a local 10K. Because when I do that, I suddenly look around, I think, wow, there are hundreds of people. Yeah. I mean, all these medals on the wall here. These are just fun runs, most of these. Yeah. Most of these are just, they're just local runs that I go and do so that every now and again I can look around and go, 200 people here, all out after the same goal, the same thing. Yeah, if you went and found 200 random people in the high street, you're only going to find two or three that can even run. But when you go to an event like that, because you pluck them from all over and you bring them together, you are able to think, okay, we aren't the norm, but when you gather us together, there are still plenty of us. And I find that inspiring. I wouldn't want to live like that. I wouldn't want to be so immersed in those communities that it's all I know. I love the balance I have. I can remember taking Jenna to a Spartan race for the first time that she came along to film. And she was just, so I run in the 45 to 50 age group. Jen's a bit younger than me, 15 years younger than me. And so her experience of men in their late 40s is, apart from me being in reasonable shape, most of them are not. So we're arriving with the other people in my age group, and you know, Sparta, and all the guys in their 40s and 50s are jacked. Yeah. And she was just looking around going, I can't believe that these people exist. Yeah. These guys are your age and older. And I said, no, it's amazing. It is amazing. If you build it, they will come. You bring them all together. So I love that community spirit of being on Zwift on a Sunday morning, thinking, there's just me in my garage. No one else is doing this. Logging onto a race and boom, there's 100 other people around the world also in their garage or wherever on a Sunday morning, or in Australia on a Sunday night, or whatever it might be, doing it as well. And so I get that gives me a perfect balance. YouTube's the same. It allows me to stick out something that I find interesting that most people probably wouldn't. And most people wouldn't find David Goggins interesting. But when you say to the entire world, who out there does?
There's a lot.
Tens of thousands of people say, oh, me. And so that's where YouTube's so brilliant. Yeah. You can just find your community in a way that if you're a David Goggins fan and YouTube didn't exist, who are you going to talk to about David Goggins? Yeah, you might have one mate that even knows who he is. That's it. But YouTube, millions of people know who he is when you take 8 billion people as your pool to gather from. So, yeah, the community thing for me, I love remembering that there are plenty of people out there doing what I'm doing. But when I then go and do it, I also like to feel, just as a motivator for myself, no one else is doing this. I did a row in the gym today, and at the end of the row, I worked so hard, I fell off, I was rolling around the floor like an idiot. And at the back of my mind was, no one else has rolled around on this floor today in this gym. No one. Everyone else has just kind of come in, gone through their, you know, their kind of half-hearted effort at doing whatever they're doing, and then kind of wandered home. I'm the only one that's rolled around this floor today. But in reality,
with your wife filming it.
With my wife, yeah, I might be the only person that rolled around on the floor with a wife filming it. But around the world today, there would have been plenty of people rolling around on the floor of their gyms also. And so I love the balance of thinking, no one's doing what I'm doing, and then be reminded, there's a few people. Yeah. And it just meshes together nicely for me.
I love that. I love that attitude. You mentioned a couple of times I've heard you mention Hunter McIntyre, who is someone I really admire that guy as well. I don't know if you saw the series on YouTube of Spartan Games or something, Spartan Games. There was a web series they did, and that's where I found him. And it had kind of all these elite athletes coming together and going at it. And his attitude, I like that. He's kind of like, I mean, he's extreme, but he's also like so, you know, wanting to be different and doing different things and putting the effort in. So,
and also completely unafraid to just be cocky and arrogant in the best possible way. I mean, it's all with such a tongue in cheek. And some people don't get that. I'm sure the same with some people don't get me. They think he's arrogant and they'd like that. But he's when I watch him, I'm just laughing at his attitude.
Yeah. And his
but equally, indeed. And he calls himself the bulk pony and all this sort of stuff. And before an event, he'll be kind of tweeting the other people in it and telling them, you know, who's going to be second and all this sort of stuff. And I just love it. But equally, I saw him. He raced in Dallas, High Rocks, recently. In the run-up to it, he's on Instagram winding up the people that he's going to beat, and he gets beaten himself.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah.
Right. And the next day, he's not. Yeah. You could be thinking, wow, he's made himself look a bit stupid. All the big talk. The next day, he's on Instagram back in the snow in Colorado, wherever he lives. Running, just running. And he's, I'm running because it sucked yesterday or last week. Yeah. I'm back at it. I'm out and I'm getting after it again. And next time it'll be better. I just love his attitude.
Yeah. He also was like really congratulating the guy who won. I think it was German guy or something like that. And
Ryan Kent beat him. Yeah. He was just a perfect sports person.
Yeah, he's good. He's a real good guy. So listen, I've got one more question to ask you. So long term above average, right? I mean, I've noticed, and a lot of your audience, if they've stuck with us this long, by the way, thank you so much for sticking with us this long. That's awesome. But I've noticed, and I'm sure a lot of your audience have noticed, that you know, you've been, now you've moved into a category that is significantly above average in certain aspects, and you can't deny that yourself. There's certain things you're achieving which are definitely well above average. How do you do that? What's the long-term goal now? I mean, you've got 100,000 viewers to get rid of your kids' YouTube plaque. You know, that'll be nice. 100,000 subscribers, sorry. But then what's next? What are you hoping to take? Where do you see yourself going with all of this, and what will keep you motivated and sense of purpose and positive?
It's a good question. I mean,
finally, took an hour and a half to get a good question. Great.
I mean, to a certain extent, I almost don't care is the wrong word, because if it goes badly, if it fails, I would care. I'm just intrigued to see where it goes. That's probably the best way of describing it. For example, one of the problems I have right now on YouTube is that because I've had so many people watch that Kipchoge video, there's a part of me that thinks, well, hang on a minute, that has boosted my numbers, not artificially, because they're real people watching a real video, but I need another one to do that. I need another million view video to come along in the next few months. And what if it doesn't? And one of the things I learned from working in sales, I'd have a boss that would always say to me, Mark, it's been 3 months since your last big investment, you know, what's your plan? And my plan was, I'd always say, my plan is to do what I've always done and just wait for another big investment, and it will happen. And after 10, 15, 20 years of it happening, he stopped asking me. And the same thing, I just assume, you know, I've done a few videos that have had hundreds of thousands of views. Why won't I do another one? And it's not arrogant to think that. After a while, it just becomes, I can go back and look at videos where I know that's a good one. Why won't that happen? Why won't that happen again? So I'm just going to kind of plod on in that sense. The back of my mind, 100,000 subscribers would be, I say it would be, I mean, I'm talking as though like, will that happen? The numbers are the numbers. They are moving in that direction. So there is a slight inevitability to it, really. It almost becomes a snowballing effect. You can't stop. I could not make any more YouTube videos, and just people watching the old stuff would keep the numbers ticking away a little bit. And that isn't the plan. So 100,000 subscribers would be great. Doing it, my old business is getting sold, and YouTube will be what I do full time. Because of the sale of the old business, I don't need millions of subscribers on YouTube to make a business from it. 100,000 would be amazing. It would be ample. In terms of what I want to do on YouTube, it's a tricky one. The reason I'm doing things right now, like Hyrox, like rowing, where I am more physically suited, and I am, there is no doubt, I am better than average at some of those things. So for rowing, for example, just through natural gift of being huge, no real rowing skill, I am at an elite level of indoor rowing, just through luck. I mean, I didn't ask to be 6'6". It's down. And it becomes slightly unrelatable, and I don't want that to happen. One of the reasons the Kipchoge video was so good is because 6'6", 100 kilo person is never going to be anywhere. I mean, I am relatable to normal people. Normal people can watch me and go, oh, he's a bit faster than me, maybe, or maybe he's not, but I can see what he's doing. He does a 20-minute park run. I do a 27 minutes, so I can see what he's doing.
Yeah.
Kipchoge is doing 14-minute park runs 8 times in a row to do a tour. I can't see what he's doing. So people see me as a sort of a conduit to understanding what someone else is doing. The trouble with things where I'm getting quite good is that I become too far from the norm, and then they can't see me as a conduit to that. They just say he's just another elite person. It's a bit like I'm 6'6". People sometimes say to me, "Oh, he was tall, wasn't he?" I think, was he? Yeah, he must have been 6'1". I don't know, 6'1", 5'8", it all looks the same to me. They're all so short. I can't tell. unless when I see someone that's 6'7", I go, oh, you are tall because you're.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I don't want to be so far away from normal people that they can't tell whether, you know, 6'6", 7 foot, all the same. So Hyrox is a bit of a treat for me. It's an opportunity for me to go and do something that I do find myself physically suited to. Not at an elite level at all, but pretty good, and have a play at. And that's what I'm doing now until April. I work real hard training for Hyrox. I would love to get on the podium for my age group. I have a potential problem there because the London event has become so popular, probably because of my video, that the numbers are huge for it. So that means there's an awful lot of people, and more people means obviously more competition.
Yeah.
So it may not happen, but a podium at Hyrox in my age group would be mind-blowing. Once I've done that, or once I've raced, wherever I come, however I do, that will be the last time, probably, that I race Hyrox solo, because it is a bit of a treat for me. Excuse me, it's not relatable to average people to watch someone turn up at an event like that and get on the podium. That isn't what I'm trying to do. That is what YouTube's about for me. So the next Hyrox that I'm doing with Jenna. We're going to go and do pairs.
That's cool.
Because that's cool and it's fun. And I'm more excited about doing that in Birmingham in October. And again, we're going to go back in November to London and do pairs again. I'm more excited about that in a way than racing on my own because we're going to be at the back on some things. Jen's not a great, she can run, she's not a great runner. We're going to be struggling to stay off the back on some things.
Yeah.
And I love that. I talk about this in the videos a lot. I would rather be almost last, fighting to not be last, thinking there is so much more I can do to improve, than where I am now with Hyrox, where I'm thinking, it's literally what I've always said you shouldn't do. I'm close to the top, but not at the top. And so you become just fueled by this irrational desire to improve tenths of a second here and there. It fills your day, it fills your time. It sucks, quite frankly. My training at the moment is killing me. To do what? To go from a 1 hour 18 Hyrox to a 1 hour 11 or something. It's nonsense.
However, if I can interrupt you, sorry. I feel like just speaking back to the kind of attitude of a little bit about selfishness, but also a little bit about taking care of yourself. Maybe over time you have evolved. Well, you have evolved into what you are now. So forgiving yourself for wanting to have that competitive moment, because I think your audience, my guess is your audience will totally forgive you for that, because you are a good role model and you've tracked this journey. You know, anyone looking back over your videos, you can, like, I even showed my wife, I'm like, I'm interviewing this guy, look at this, is it like just 2 years ago or whatever, and this is him now, and she was like, whoa. Yeah. You know, and 2 years ago or whatever, you were already pretty fit, right? I mean, you know your South Africa video and stuff, it was already like it was you were in good shape, but like clearly you've had a really good progression, and I think anyone watching is going to find that inspiring as well. And it's fun to watch people compete to win something, or compete to podium, or compete to go against themselves. It's fun to see those parameters and understand. You detail in your videos about, you know, knowing the split times and various things, and the time you're spending in the waiting areas or whatever it's called, the transition areas.
That, like, the rock zone.
All of that is like, it's interesting for a viewer. So I think you shouldn't maybe define my advice, and not that it was asked for or is probably useful at all to you,
I'll take it
is that, you know, don't worry too much about what the audience needs from you in terms of like being the average guy and having that, you know, worry more about what you need and hope that they'll come along with you on that journey. I think that's probably what's worked for you so far. And
I think so. I there is no question that while I'm saying the more important thing to me is racing with Jen. If I was to get on the podium, when you get on the podium, you get this sort of cheap looking tea towel thing with the position on it. Yeah. It's a Hyrox call it a flag. It's a tea towel. But if I had one of those hanging up here, I would be incredibly proud. And I mean, that would just be amazing. So I do want that. The thing I'm trying to do as well, I still try to keep it fun. So, for example, my training day today was a rest day, and I'm doing a 2K row in the gym that nearly kills me for another video. And last weekend, my rest day was the Goggins challenge. So my higher-ups coach, Dave Peters, is probably pulling his hair out because he's put together this training program that I'm supposed to be following that says rest day, and I'm off doing something stupid. So I'm not taking it super, super serious. And also, I already know the video that I make about the journey, the 8, 9, 10 week journey to High Rocks London is going to conclude, I know it is, with the summary that it was cool, it was fun, it was exciting, and it achieved X, whatever that turns out to be. But it wasn't worth it in the literal sense. Yeah. The achievement, I could have trained, I could have done a lot less and still been 99% as happy as how it turned out. And so the advice is going to be the message. I knew it would be from day one. It would be that training like an elite athlete, unless you are an elite athlete, does yield returns, but nothing like as fun returns as you get at the other end. So, for example, 26th of March, me and Nixon are racing in Wales, mountain race. I'm not a mountain racer. I get overtaken by little old ladies who are lightweight and have been doing it for 70 years and just crush me. And I cannot wait. I can't wait to make sure that I come in the top half. So if there's 100 runners, I want to be 49. And that, to me, is almost a more exciting challenge, yeah, where everything's against me. You know, my dog is too small. I'm too big. The mountain is too high. The people doing it do nothing but ultra run. And I'm training
in a stupid
way.
Is that the one you
way.
Got top dog last year? Is that the same one?
We 2019, Nixon was the fastest dog. Yeah. So we're going.
What's it called? Beast of Burden or something? No.
Beast. They do two. One's called Beast of Bodmin because it's Bodmin Moor, and the other one is Beast of the Blacks because it's Black.
Yeah,
Black
that's
Mountains.
One I think I saw. Or
yeah. Okay. So we're going. Yeah. So we want to be fastest dog, and I want to be top half human.
Nice.
And I love that. To me, that's the sort of things I'll be doing after High Rocks London and going forward. I'm already thinking about how fun it would be to try. I'm wondering what my new sport is. I follow a guy called the Vegan Cyclist, who's a
we haven't even talked. I didn't even mention your vegan community. I mean, how did we get through something and not mention veganism?
Jeez. Yeah, well, I never. No, it's a good example. I never talk about being vegan. Everyone thinks vegans do nothing but rabbit on about.
You still got him
lettuce.
In there. I'm just kidding.
I never talk about. So the Vegan Cyclist. He's a road cyclist. He's recently got into doing cycle cross, which is basically gravel riding. Yeah. It looks awesome fun. Just kind of racing on a road bike with bouncy tires over gravel. And again, I'd be rubbish at it because I'm just the wrong shape for that sort of sport. But I'm really tempted this summer to try. There's along the Ridgeway, there's a gravel bike race. And it just looks that sort of thing to me that I would love to turn up and do with no experience of it and no chance of doing well. But looking at the results afterwards and thinking 500 people did that race and I was 250. Those are the sort of things that I like. Yeah. And hopefully those are the sort of things that have real kind of appeal to everybody that can just go, you know, it's not a, because I know some of the comments I'll get on some videos where I do well, because I get the comments already where people say, well, of course you can do that. You're this, you're that, you're big, those sort of things. I've got a video coming on this, actually. It's on my list of videos pending. People seem to have forgotten how to be inspired by people, and social media has caused it.
Totally.
So what used to happen, when I was a kid, actually, how old are you?
44.
Okay, so 48. Okay, so when I was a kid, I would be inspired by Brian Jacks doing Superstars or Daley Thompson at the Olympics or watching Sylvester Stallone take off his robe in Rocky IV and never having seen anyone so ripped.
By the way, I watched Rocky home. In preparation for this. I'm not even joking. Good. I watched Rocky just to prepare myself for this.
There you go. You suck down a raw egg and go
Mark
for a jog.
Talks about the Rocky soundtrack all the time. I'm sure he's gutted that he can't have it on his YouTube videos for...
One day I hope Stallone will give me a call and say, hey, you can, you know,
go for it.
I'll let you have a little fit. That's about as much as I can ever use.
Inspired in the 80s.
Inspired, yeah. Right, absolutely. So I would then use that motivation to go and do what I did, whatever it was at the time. I didn't want to be a decathlete like Daley Thompson. I certainly didn't want to be a boxer. It looked horrific. And who was the other one? Brian Jacks. I couldn't do dips. So I just took from them inspiration and then took it and went and did my thing. And what seems to have happened now is that because social media, people think that they have much closer affinity with the person they're seeing, that they think that inspiration means copy.
Yeah.
So when they see someone doing something on Instagram or YouTube, whatever it is, they think that what they're supposed to do is look like that or be like, which is why you get so many people complaining about how people look. It's an unrealistic this, that, and the other. Well, is it unrealistic? Yeah, probably. But so what? Yeah. You're not supposed to copy them. Was Rocky IV? Stallone was unrealistic then. Stallone trained for Rocky IV under Franco Colombo, one of Arnold Schwarzenegger's mates. Stallone wasn't remotely natural when he did Rocky IV, but it doesn't matter. I'm not supposed to become an Italian American and take steroids and take up boxing. That isn't what I'm supposed to do. And so what's happened now is that people, yeah, they watch stuff on YouTube and they think, well, I can't look like that. Well, you're not supposed to look like that. That's not the message. When you watch my videos, you're not supposed to do what I do. If you want to do what I do, crack on. But you're supposed to simply be entertained and motivated to go and then do what you want to do. I watched Alex Honnold's free solo climbed up El Capitan.
It's so crazy.
I watched it. And all I could think about the next day was, I need to go and achieve something today. That's bonkers. But I'm inspired to achieve something. And as someone that grew up learning that that's how you're supposed to be inspired, it worked for me perfectly. So the inspiration thing is an interesting one. I find that people are very hung up on, for example, with the Kipchoge video and the Bradley Wiggins video, I put up those videos and people say, but he's light, or but Bradley Wiggins was on a bike made in a wind tunnel. And I just think, what are you people talking about? That is a human being doing something incredible. I don't care if he's on a £1 million bike and he's had his arms removed to be lighter. He's doing something incredible. Yeah. Be inspired by it and then go run with your dog. You're not supposed to go, well, it means nothing. I had a guy say to me, once I can learn nothing from you for your channel because you're huge. You don't understand. You've got a natural ability to do these things. What do you mean you can learn nothing? The same day as I had that text message from someone saying it's pointless you showing us you doing this bench press or something because you're physically gifted, blah 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 blah. I had another DM from someone that said, this was a lady in Canada. She said, I'm 50 pounds overweight. But today I've decided I'm going to be above average. I'm going to get my dog and we're going to go for a run. And you've motivated me to do that. And I just want to say thank you. I thought, wow, the guy that thinks you can learn nothing from my channel needs to talk to that woman who's gone for a run in the Canadian woods with her dog. I haven't done that. The inspiration thing. I've even changed recently on YouTube my banner to say entertainment, motivation. It's not instruction. No. It's not advice, really. It's not the vegan thing is a good example. I don't say be a vegan. I'd say, hey, this is how I eat. Hopefully it's funny and entertaining. do what you like, quite frankly. But if it motivates you to eat better,
yeah, good. I think you do find that a really good balance, actually. So I was actually laughing because I realised I have this behind me here. I don't know if you can see it. No, you can't see it. The Atomic Habits, which you did, which you did a whole video.
I love it. I love the book.
I haven't finished it yet because I'm a very, very slow reader, and I haven't got Audible here because it's not available. Blah blah blah.
I was going to say, I bought the book for YouTube. Yeah, really, I listened to it on audiobooks.
I will read it, though, because I actually have trained as a life coach and an executive coach, and I have talked most of my life about goals and stuff. And I've been really, ever since I trained as a coach, really into goals and very goal-oriented. And your video, plus a few other things I'd heard, it wasn't just your video, but like, it sparked this thing of like, yeah, that's what I meant. Habits. It's so much about habits, because the goal is pointless if you don't take a step and do something about it. And I loved that video that you made there. And it's like, so yeah, you weren't being super preachy. You weren't instructing, but what you had to say about it was extremely inspirational and change. It did make a change. So people always talk about don't read the negative comments, don't read the comments and the whatever, but of course I understand it's difficult not to, and you clearly want to engage with your audience as much as you can, so I understand the temptation.
There's an interesting flip side. I can remember watching Joe Rogan years ago where he said to whoever, I think it was somebody newly famous on his podcast, and he said, don't read the comments, just don't. I never do it. Joe saying that himself. And I remember thinking, oh, if I ever became super famous, I'd do what Joe says. I wouldn't read negative. And
I think he was talking, I think I know exactly. So I've gone off Joe Rogan recently, but Lex Friedman, I think, is the guy he was talking to.
Right.
Lex Friedman is one of my favorite podcasters, actually. So.
I remember him talking to Dave Chappelle, who says the same thing. Famously doesn't read his negative comments. And I agree. I haven't listened to him much since he went to Spotify. But I'm thinking, when I'm famous, I won't read the comments. When I'm famous. And now I do read the comments. And part of me thinks, like, in a way, you kind of want to read the negative comments. I like constructive negative comments. If someone, because they're actually quite useful. Someone's saying, oh, it's good, it's good, it's good. That's lovely to hear, but it doesn't help.
Yeah.
But someone saying, it'd be better if it was this. I'll take that on board. It's when people just say just stupid negative, your video means, if someone said to me, oh, the Kipchoge video was funny, somebody said, oh, you're on a running machine, and a running machine scientifically will be easier to travel along than the ground. I was like, dude, what are you on about? I'm on a running machine. I lasted 2 minutes at Kipchoge's pace and then died.
Who's sitting there in the world has got time to watch your video, then go, I'm gonna get them now. And I'm gonna type on my keyboard.
What was funny was I took that guy's comment and I pinned it to the top of the comments on that Kipchoge video. and I said something like, this is good that you've said this. This is quite beneficial, because my worry was that Kipchoge would watch the video and feel embarrassed by how good my performance was.
I think I saw that, actually.
But now he can, take some solace from the fact that I was basically cheating on the running machine. And of course, with the number of subscribers that I have now, they kind of all waded in and ripped the guy apart, which serves him right. But it did make me think, you're supposed to watch that video and just think, man, I'm going to pick up that guitar that I've wanted to learn how to play, or whatever it is. You're not supposed to go, oh, but the running machine, blah, blah, blah.
Well, listen, Mark, that is a great place to finish on, because I want to say you are an inspiration. You're an awesome guy, and I wish you all the success that is coming your way. So you will be famous one day, and who knows, maybe this podcast will get listened to by a few people. So, and I hope you enjoyed the conversation. I loved it.
I did. I love talking about it.
Keep being a fan of yours, and I'll hopefully run into you in some race at some point. I'll soon be in your age range, so I better get training.
Although I then move above. It's a constantly
very briefly. I'll find you next year and do a spot
absolutely.
Or something.
Yeah,
but listen, thank you so much, Mark, for your time. And just before we wrap up completely, is there anything you kind of want to promote? I notice you haven't been good at promoting your Instagram, so I think people should go and follow you there, because that seems to be a place where you get like some interesting snapshots in your life. And
yeah, Instagram is kind of is what it is. It's kind of behind the scenes stuff. So that's Mark Lewis Picks. Mark Lewis was stolen, and I'm not famous enough for Instagram to just rip it from the actual Mark Lewis, whoever he is, and give it to me. And also, I now have a website as well. Actually, the website's quite useful. Yes. So marklewis.co.uk. It's a work in progress, but it is a place where I've collated everything. So from there, you can find YouTube. You can find the gear I use, because lots of people always ask me what gear I'm using. That's going to be up in a couple of days. So yeah, anything you want of mine, marklewis.co.uk, and off you go.
Yeah, and obviously go and subscribe to his YouTube. Anyone that's still listening at this point in the podcast, subscribe as well. Subscribe to my YouTube as well while you're at it, just because, you know, make me feel better. And these podcasts go up there. But yeah, thank you so much, Mark, and all the best. You take care of yourself, and good luck in that race in Wales.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, thanks for listening. For those still here, if you're still here, please do review it. It would be really useful to me. I haven't really pushed too hard with these podcasts. It's been a personal project so far, but I figure why not ask? If you've got a chance to review or rate on Apple Podcasts or whatever platform you're using, that would be super useful. Thank you so much, and I'll see you in the next episode.